Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Carol High, a member of the club's Asia Pacific Affairs Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Keith Goldstein first visited Nepal over 20 years ago and has since returned many times. Keith co-founded Nepal Seeds to work towards improving life for the people of Nepal. His organization has been recognized as the most effective NGO working in eastern Nepal. Please help me welcome Keith Goldstein.
Thanks a lot, Carol, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club for letting me come here this evening to talk to you. I hope you can all understand me. I have somewhat of a distinctive drawl. Some of you may recognize it as being from the south side of Potrero Hill, where I've lived for about 35 years now. I must say I'm quite proud to be here at the Commonwealth Club this evening and somewhat intimidated. But I look around and see a lot of friendly faces in the audience. Nice to see my old mate, Henry Kissinger, there. Gavin, hello, Gavin. How are you, all right? Barack, hiding in the back. Oops. Even His Holiness showed up. Thanks a lot, Dalai Lama. Tuche, tashe delek to you. Namaste. Some of you who have been there must know that that is the greeting in Nepal that everybody uses traditionally with the hands clasped together. Namaste means I bow to the inner light within you. We clasp the hands and it's a very spiritual greeting, and so you sort of know a little bit about what Nepal's about when you meet somebody and they do this to you, and it's somewhat different to the "what's up, dude" that we're used to hearing over here. I first went to Nepal in 1986. Where is Nepal? In 1986, I'd actually wanted to go there ever since I was a young boy in England, and I read about Hillary's exploits, and he was something of a hero for all citizens of the British Commonwealth when he and Norgay Tenzing were the first people to climb Everest in 1953. It was sort of a dream of mine for a very long time, and when I left university in England in 1972, it was a toss-up between the spirituality of Nepal or chasing girls in America, and the girl chasing one out. So I have some very, very strong connections with Nepal. I've traveled there a lot of times. I co-founded a relief organization that does projects in Nepal. I also own a company. I'm a contractor in San Francisco. My company is called Everest Waterproofing and Restoration. Further cementing my ties with Nepal. And among my workforce, I have about 24 Tibetan refugees and 7 Nepalis. And that's been a wonderfully enriching experience for me to have such loyal, conscientious, and dedicated people working in my company. And I think it's been a good experience for them, working as masons and doing those sort of skilled jobs. Nepal is actually situated in a sort of quite a strategic position between China here and India here, the two most populous countries in the world. And I think right now I've been reading that they're the two countries that are the only ones that are showing positive growth at the present time. Recently, China in the last several years has been making a lot of overtures to Nepal, building roads straight from Kathmandu to into China and up to through Tibet and into Lhasa, and this actually India finds quite frightening and intimidating. And so Nepal has a lot of strategic importance, And for those of you who have been there, you probably recognize some of these places here. Lumbini is where the Buddha gained enlightenment, and I'm sure a lot of you have been to Pokhara and trekked up into the Annapurnas. The Royal Chitwan, the Chitwan Forest, of course, Kathmandu, Lukla, where you take the planes, where you fly into Lukla to start trekking up to Sagarmatha, Everest. Koshitapu, which is a place where we recently did some very interesting projects that I can tell you about a little later. And I just hit the wrong thing again. I'm sorry about that. Okay, Mazel Tov. The Nepal flag is actually quite an interesting flag. Believe it or not, it's the only flag of all the nations in the world that is not rectangular in shape. The flag symbolizes some different things: the mountains of Nepal, the sun and the moon, and unfortunately, it also symbolizes the royal family and the traditional Rana family that ruled Nepal for many, many years. The fact the prime ministers were all Ranas, and but things have changed since Nepal became a republic, and I'm not too sure if they're going to change their flag to just acknowledge that it means more the sun and the moon than the royal family. Some statistics about Nepal: 30 million people. I think that we have about 30 million people in California, except we earn a little more than $450 per year. The majority of the people living there are subsistence farmers, which means they spend most of their life just trying to grow enough food to feed their family. And unfortunately, most of them are unsuccessful with that. They typically live to about 60 years. Literacy is far higher for men than for women. It's such a key element of life for people there. And I mean, if you ever go trekking there, when they ask you for pens, they just want a pen because they figure that literacy is their key to a way out of this poverty and this existence of being a subsistence farmer. And, you know, the kids start working in the fields usually when they're about 6 years old. I hope I didn't hit the wrong one again here. Not surprisingly, it's one of the poorest countries in the world. Over one third of the population been living below the poverty line, and it's got all these things going against it. It's completely landlocked, so you know you're not going to find a harbour, you know, or a port in Nepal for trade. It's been very, very remote forever, and for many, many years they didn't allow people to come in there, and it's very hilly, and you can't really do much, and it's just terribly technologically backward. It really hit me last year. I went to Italy and I was in Pompeii and I saw these sophisticated irrigation systems and toilets that they had that the Romans built 2,000 years ago. And in Nepal, you know, there's nothing like that still. You know, they still go outdoors in the fields where they're growing the vegetables, and so they've still got a long way to go, but. And one of the main banes of existence there is that there's civil strife there. It seems to me that although as wonderful as the Nepali people are when you meet them, and they're warm and friendly and spiritual, they don't get along with each other a lot. You know, they tend to look after themselves. The provincialism reigns. You know, if somebody gets into a position of authority, he wants to look after himself, his family, and his clan. You know, and there's not a lot of that image of the greater good, which I think is a problem with a lot of developing countries. And having said that, the fact that Nepal stepped back from the brink of civil war a few years ago is a very, very encouraging sign. So some of you know about the Maoist revolution that went on and was really tearing the country apart. And the Maoists were dedicated to the overthrow of the government and the monarchy and instituting a communist government there. And the army didn't just hit back with their full force. They They would just indiscriminately attack villages where they thought there were Maoist sympathizers. And for a while there, people wouldn't even gather in groups in Nepal. You know, if maybe 20 Nepalis were walking through the hills, they were terrified that the army might see them as a Maoist cadre and just drop a bomb on them and wipe them out. So it was a terrible thing, killed 12,000 people. And, you know, look at, these are the Maoist kids, and they were not messing about. they would, it's unbelievable old-fashioned Maoist ideology, you know, that you thought had disappeared about 20 years ago. One thing about it was that they basically left tourists alone. I mean, they weren't killing tourists or capturing and taking them hostages. They would ask for a donation whilst you were trekking of some silly $10 or something for the cause, and they'd actually give you a receipt for that. So, you know, it's unbelievable. So they did realize what a great source of income tourism is to the country. And I mean, they've got the Maoist revolution going on, they've got all this civil strife, they're abject poverty, you know, for loads of the places, and then they get into this situation that, what was it, 8 years ago, this bloke Dipendra kills his mum and dad and a whole bunch of other people, and Dipendra happens, you know, they'd be the king and queen that he's wiped out. And King Birendra's rather unpopular brother, Gyanendra, takes over as king and vows to quash the Maoists. And from everything I can gather, Gyanendra had spent most of his time as Prince Gyanendra trying to make as much money and exploit the people as he possibly could. And he thought that maybe he can just get rid of the Maoists, which was not a very smart tack to take. So this civil war raged and killed all these people and kept going on here. And then amazingly, they basically stepped back from the brink. You know, they just realized that it looked intractable to me. The Maoists were dedicated to destroying the current system. The government was not going to give up power. The king certainly didn't want to stop his position. But then they all realized that it was tearing the country apart. And in the midst of this inability to get along normally, they actually somehow figured out how to sit down and work it out. And the Maoists went into the free elections, and the Maoists became the big party and joined the government and ended the violence. But meanwhile, the Maoist army was not integrated into the regular army, and they didn't give up all their arms. So there's still this sort of threat going around. And as Carol alluded to, there were some big developments this week. So the king hit the road, basically. In May 2008, the parliament got rid of the monarchy, and Nepal is now our youngest republic on the planet. He actually stayed in Nepal, went to a country estate, which sort of really shocked a lot of people. You know, we figured he'd take sacks and 747s full of rupees over to some little state in Africa and hang out with one of his corrupt pals over there. But he's actually hanging out in Nepal, and I don't think anybody really regrets his absence. I've always been terribly disappointed in the Nepal royal family. If you've been to Nepal, you'll see that all homes and businesses, traditionally, every home and business would have a photograph of the king and queen on the wall. And the royal family itself had put out this image of being, they have a divine right to their royal lineage. So there was considered as something of divinity. That's gone. And they never did anything, to my mind, to really advance the welfare of the people, to try and drag the people out of poverty. I really got the impression that they were just trying to maximize their profits whilst they were in power there. So it's good to get rid of them. I just talked about these different items, and there's still a lot of people who are still very scared of the Maoists. I mean, they engage in a lot of blackmail. They threaten to kidnap children of families to fight in their army. They get businesses to give them money, or just straight-out blackmail under the threat of violence. And although that's somewhat diminished, they're still a force to be reckoned with. And then there's just a terrible mess in the country right now where, because of really terrible planning and corruption and a very, very poor monsoon, there's no power right now. So every home has 18-hour power outages every day. In Kathmandu, of course, a lot of the country is without power anyway. And they don't know how to figure it out because they just all squabble with each other. And so and this provincialism I alluded to and corruption stops them being able to figure out how to get this sorted out. So the Prime Minister is Prachanda, who was the leader of the Maoist Revolution, a committed Maoist revolutionary. He wanted to fire the Chief of Staff of the Army because the Chief of Staff refused to integrate the Maoist fighters into the Nepali Army. And the president, who is from the old traditional Congress party, refused to go along and wouldn't fire the army chief of staff. And so Prachanda's resigned, and, you know, there's some threat now that the Maoists could pick up arms again, although the general feeling is that they can't turn back and that they will continue on the road to peace. So there is some hope, but there's still 18-hour power failures. And let me show you some pictures now of the people and the country, and because talking about politics in Nepal is a bit bloody depressing, I must say. I call it Kathmandu. It's a crazy place. The streets are packed. There's been a tremendous migration into Kathmandu over the last several years. People in rural areas have found it harder and harder to grow their vegetables, and they migrate to the cities in the hope of finding jobs, and there's no jobs, and they live in poverty there. And Kathmandu now has, from when I was first there, has a real pollution problem and noise and crazy, but it's a frenetic energy that I find really wonderful and intriguing and fascinating when you're there. And so, you know, here's a guy walking around with all his wares, and here's two fellas each carrying four chairs. These are sort of typical Kathmandu scenes, and the shops on the side, and the motorbikes, and every possible means of transportation you'll see, and the crowded Kathmandu streets, and surrounded by these wonderful buildings, these old buildings with this great wood carving that dates back like 500 years, and these brick buildings with these, what we call here in San Francisco, soft stories, that is not going to survive an earthquake, and they do get earthquakes there. This is an example of some of that fantastic wood carving that they do, and you can still actually go to Patan, which is one of the towns in the Kathmandu Valley, and actually buy a window exactly like that. It's pretty remarkable stuff. Here's the Kathmandu version of Whole Foods. And I guess this is probably their version of Rainbow Grocery. the grains. There's little temples everywhere. Everywhere you turn in all of South Asia and a lot in Southeast Asia, in Nepal are small temples, and they're quite elaborate. And there's three main towns in the valley. There's Kathmandu, Patan that I just talked about, and Bhaktapur. And Bhaktapur is a wonderful place to visit. It's the ancient town. They don't allow any vehicles in there. It's a very peaceful place. They don't allow people harassing you. There's only official guides to take you around, and it's full of wonderful buildings like this. So, and it's also the best tanka painters are in Kathmandu. So, if you want to pick up a tanka, I recommend visiting Bhaktapur. I met this bloke when I first went to Nepal in 1986. 20 years now, I am only milk drinking. And he calls himself Saint Only the Milk Drinker. And spent some time with this chap, and he's actually a very, very serene man. I mean, I don't know if it's because he was starving or what, but he had a very, very unusual sort of glow in his eyes. But I'm sure he'd spent many, many years meditating. When I was there last year, I actually went back to... He was living at Pashupatinath, which is the great Hindu temple complex where you see a lot of sadhus. And I went back there and I asked somebody I knew, well, what happened to Saint Only the Milk Drinker? And, well, guess what? Like all good gurus, he got a plane ticket to America and he set up his little... temple in Colorado, and understanding now travels around in a pink Rolls Royce. So Saint Only the Milk Drinker is drinking champagne, I think, these days. The street markets, I mean, obviously they sell vegetables everywhere. I don't think this is terribly different to our Ferry Plaza Farmers Market. The display of food here. If you are a tourist visiting in Nepal, I recommend against buying vegetables on the street and eating them raw without cooking them. Okay, it's, you know, especially if they wash them in front of you. Very dangerous, and I learned that to my very, very, very great distress some years ago when I bought some radishes on the side of the road and couldn't lift my head for 3 days. They have a bit of a homeless problem in Kathmandu. Not quite as bad as we have here in San Francisco. And although we don't have embankments set up on encampments on the side of the Embarcadero, this is the Ganges, and there's all sorts of activity, and there's a whole temple complex along the Ganges where a lot of elderly people go in their last days to die, and you can typically witness a cremation along the banks of the Ganges, and it's quite an elaborate affair, and it's usually surrounded by dozens of tourists taking photographs of the cremation, which is a little tasteless to my mind. More and more people are coming into Kathmandu because as a result of the global recession recently, Nepal had a tremendous number of migrant workers who were working in the Middle East, mainly in Dubai. And although they were earning a very low wage by our standards, and I'm sure by Dubai standards, they were able to send home money to their families. And most of those people have now been repatriated, unfortunately, so they... is no foreign income from the migrant workers in the Middle East, in the Gulf states. So more and more people are crowding into Kathmandu in the hopes of finding some work. And of course, there's no work there. I mean, it goes without saying that the poorest countries of the world are much harder hit by a global recession than any of us are. Well, that was Kathmandu, but most of us know Nepal, and it has most of this romantic image because it is the home to the Himalaya Mountains, the Himalayas, or as most people who visit it call it, the Himalayas. 8 of the 10 highest mountains in the world are in Nepal, and all of those 8 are higher than 8,000 meters. And as mountain climbers know, it's the 8,000 meter mountains are the really sexy ones. I believe there are 14 8,000 meter mountains in the world. And the 8 that are in Kathmandu are, there's Annapurna and Dalagiri and Manaslu and Shishipamba and Everest and Choyayu and Makalu, Kanchenjunga. I think that's the whole 8 of them there. And they're obviously a sight to behold. This is sort of an overview of the Himalayan range with of course Everest right in the middle there sticking out above the rest of them. Everest, 29,029 feet. The highest mountain in the world. First climbed, as I mentioned before, in 1953 by Ed Hillary and Norgay Tensing, and very happy to see Norgay's son Norbu is here tonight. Thanks for coming. There's some interesting facts about it. For a long time, people didn't climb Everest. You know, it was really a difficult thing to do, and there'll be a few people each year who made it up to Everest. There's now been 4,100 ascents of Everest, successful ascents, by 2,700 different people. 210 people have died trying to climb Everest. You could probably make it if you've got $65,000 to spare and want to pay an agency to take you up there. You probably need a little bit of experience. In 2007, there were 750 people who made it to the top of Everest. Now, they're just doing it a few days. This right now is the climbing season. Late April, May is when you can get to the top, when there's a good chance with the weather. And who knows how many people will make it this year, I have a feeling. But there are actual traffic jams up there. There's all these movements to clean the garbage off of Everest, and, you know, and they go around. I mean, frankly, I could care less if there's garbage on Everest, you know, so it's going to offend these people who want to fulfill this ego trip of getting to the top. And excuse me if any of you have climbed Everest. The country has far, far greater needs. And there's also, you know, everybody's after the next record for being the first one-eyed, one-legged, 4'6" person to make it to the top of Everest. I took this photograph when I hiked up to the very modest Gokyo Ri, which is at about 17,600 feet, and it's a pretty darn good view. Everest and Lhotse on the right, and Lhotse Sar, and of course Everest. And I took that photo from Gokyo Ri, and I took this photo when I was up in the space shuttle one day, and this one came out quite well, this one. So a lot of us discover the Himalayas, more of us discover the Himalayas by trekking rather than by mountain climbing. Here's a typical trekking scene. Trudging your way through the Himalayas, and here's Everest again. The interesting thing about Everest, and you saw that in that panoramic view of all the mountains, is that the top of Everest is what? It doesn't have any snow. You know, very often the snow gets blown off. You know, look how black that is. This is Machu Picchu, Fishtail Mountain in the Annapurna Range. The Annapurnas are the most visited part of Nepal. Has far more trekkers than any other part of Nepal, substantially more than the Khumbu region, and those two are far ahead of anybody else. And they're actually building some pretty fancy guest houses there. You don't have to sleep on a wooden board anymore and not wash for 10 days and go to the bathroom in a hole in the ground, you know, and they actually have running water and hot water and these places. Unfortunately, a lot of the hot water has come at the cost of great deforestation in Nepal. They've lost, 80% of the energy in the country comes from firewood. I mean, it's the easiest thing to do is just chop down a tree and build a fire. Happily, in most of the tourist areas now, the energy is coming from propane or from other fuel. And also, they're instituting biogas. And in fact, our organization has started building some biogas systems for some villages in southern Nepal. It's a very simple system. Powered by human and animal waste. We build this tank here, and all the waste goes in here. And there's some lines running into the home, and believe it or not, you turn on the valve and you get heat there, and you can boil your water and do the cooking, and it's very, very effective. And we're seeing more and more biogas systems. The trouble with biogas is that it's quite expensive to build one system, and one system can really only serve one household. And so we've been quite limited in the number of biogas systems that we've been able to build. But besides being able to cook on demand, it's a tremendously environmental thing to do. So it's a great future for Nepal. This is the Lungtung region. I was there about a year, year and a half ago, and it sort of reminds me of a Swiss village here, you know, with these large guest houses. Nice area to visit. Easy to get to, not a difficult trek if you want to go to Lungtung. The yak. You find yaks sort of between, I think it's 10,000 and 13,000 feet. And they're like they're the national animal of Nepal, I guess, and the Tibetan plateau. And they're an unbelievably useful animal. And that's why the Tibetan Buddhists don't mind eating yak meat, because they make use of every part of the yak. And I know that they don't like Tibetan Buddhists won't eat seafood, shellfish, because a plate of prawns is eating like 20 spirits, and whereas a good meat curry, you've hopefully used the whole animal. I know the Dalai Lama, when he was here just a couple of weeks ago, visited St. Martin de Porres shelter in San Francisco, and I have some connections with that shelter, and they were telling me that they were going to prepare a vegetarian meal, and I said, well, the bloke loves to eat meat, you know, and but and he does. The yak does, so you get the meat, you get milk, you get yak tea and yak butter, which you'll be offered in many, many places as you travel around, and it doesn't, I can't get a taste for it, but some people love it. The blood is used for medicine and sausages. The wool on the yak for clothes and blankets and mats. They use the hair to make ropes and tents. The tail is used in religious ceremonies. The hide is used for leather, and the horns as religious instruments. They make buttons and other ornaments out of the bones. And, of course, it's a beast of burden. You know, it carries things around. And then yak dung itself is a major source of fuel, and they actually use it as a building material, which is a good thing. Yak turds do not smell bad because they eat green wild grass. It smells quite nice, actually. I sprinkled some on myself today before the presentation, and I've seen it. I'm a waterproofing contractor in San Francisco, and I was intrigued at how they waterproof the walls in this village near the Tibet border. And I was thinking of bringing out a product called Yak Turd 1A. I thought that could be a very good market for it. And I paid off these couple of yaks to pose for this photograph for me. Very, very, very nice of them. Great mountains. As I was hiking up to Gokyo Ri, and this is Gokyo Lake, and the other two lakes whose names I can't remember. And this is the Everest Glacier. This is the Everest Glacier, and it's sort of washed out up here is Everest. So. These are marvelous views, and this is sort of getting closer to the lake and the sort of things that you're likely to see if you go trekking over there, and some more mountain views. Whenever you get to a pass, there'll be prayer flags and other religious ornamentation. A nice view of the mountains, and you can really be out there. And part of the whole thing about trekking is crossing these wonderful bridges that they build across. Nepal is a lot of up and down, into the valley, back up again, down, back up again. Somebody told me that Ne means up and Pal means down. And you can't get away from that. This bridge scared the heck out of me. This is near Namche Bazaar when you're trekking. But I was warned here, never try and cross a bridge when a yak herd is coming or right after a yak herd. I mean, it's a terrifying sight to see yaks cross these bloody things, you know, and you wonder if it's going to make it. I better pick up the speed here. These are some of our trekkers. This is Seth. Seth was my Sherpa some years ago, and Seth is now the superintendent for my company. He's come to live over here, so those are wonderful sort of connections. And KP here is the executive director and the founder of our organization, Seeds. And this is my very long-suffering wife, who always accompanies me on these trips. And we've just left the comfort of one of these little guest houses here, and we got to set off trudging through the snow for about 8 hours to our next port of call. And this is a typical day's trekking in Nepal. And just one very quick story. We were in this village here, which is Sama, and we got stuck in this blizzard here, and we were trapped there, and we met these young fellas there. And they didn't look like everybody else. They were dressed in sort of Western clothes, most of them. And they weren't properly dressed, and some of them had snow blindness. And so we found out that they were Tibetan refugees who had just fled from Tibet and were on their way to Dharamsala to be with the Dalai Lama. And a lot of them had snow blindness, and one of our group, one of the directors of our organization, is a doctor, and she came up with an ingenious idea. She took our power bars and made glasses out of the power bars so that they could resist the snow blindness. And I happened to have in my pocket a whole slew of photographs of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And these people were sitting there with frostbite and snow blindness and wondering what was going on. I gave them each a photo of the Dalai Lama, and it was a very, very, very touching moment. He wasn't touched. And then we then took them over this pass. We hired local guides, and these Tibet 20 monks, one nun and one dog accompanied us over the pass, and they bloody wouldn't stop talking. They're yakking and talking away the whole time, and it's really, you know, there's been this unbelievable storms and there's blizzards, and I can hear avalanches blasting off, and you know, and I'm worried they're going to stop all these avalanches. Unfortunately, we didn't get this close to one of the avalanches that day. 3 days later, we saw the monks and the nun in a forest just outside of Kathmandu, and so I don't know where they had them, but they were changing into their red robes, and they were home and safe on their way to Dharamsala to be with the Dalai Lama, so that had a very happy ending. And at the end of the trekking day, you're always going to run a very good chance that you'll find a scene like this. So, briefly, 80%, these are the composition of the people who live in Nepal. It's funny, there's a lot of disharmony there, but it doesn't seem to be religious-based, you know. There's certainly no Islamic fundamentalist movement there, and the Hindus and the Buddhists have very closely related religions, and they get on well. So I'd been going there for some years, and in 1998, I co-founded this organization, Seeds, which specializes in grassroots relief to Nepal's poorest villages. And we are a very effective NGO working in Nepal, although I have to give credit to the American Himalayan Foundation, upon which is a San Francisco-based organization, which does absolutely fantastic work and is also based here in San Francisco. I was inspired to start the organization by KP Kafley, the stupid-looking guy with the sunglasses there. And no, KP was my trekking guide. KP's a really interesting fellow. He was born in a village in Kathmandu, received no education. At the age of 15, he walked out of his village, walked all the way to India, and got a job as a servant for a family there. Saved some money, learned a bit of English, walked back, got probably paid for a bus back to Kathmandu, got a job in a hotel and then a restaurant there, started making friends with American trekkers there, started taking Americans trekking, inspired me and a couple of other people to start Seeds, and now leads treks for REI as well as being the executive director of our organization. Last year received REI's award for the most popular trekking guide. So he's a wonderful, wonderful partner, and he walked out of his village with ignorant, you know, at 15 years old. So he's a remarkable partner. And this is a list of all the different projects that we've done, and and these are the main areas that we do our work. A lot of our work is centered in the Tibetan areas, on the Tibetan border here, but we also do work in the lower lands here. That's not far from Kathmandu, neither's that. And this is that same satellite photo. So a lot of our work is in that place where we were stranded, where I showed you where we met the Tibetans. And we got stranded there for 4 days, got to know the people there, and we've started a lot of our projects in the Nubri Valley, where no child had ever received a first grade education until we got started with our projects there, and there was absolutely zero healthcare there. We've built clinics that provide a mix of Ayurvedic and Western care, and we'll pull your nose off if you want somebody to do that. And this is one of the nuns, the Ani, who's looking after the people. Our board directors, Jeff Charles, we met. He was living up there when I first met him, doing a demographic study. He's a demographic anthropologist, and he'd been living there for 9 months, and he found that childhood mortality under 5 years old was 50% when we first arrived there, and so we've instituted these clinics and these women's health training programs to teach some of the very basics of public health. There's very, very simple ways that you can get rid of this high infant mortality rate. So this is what it's like. Look at the difference between Afghanistan and Nepal. When I looked this up, I was shocked. Nepal's not doing bad against Afghanistan. And I bet adult mortality is probably worse than infants in Afghanistan right now. So before we got there, it was 50%. Since we started these programs, it's gone down to 0.5%. It's unbelievable. And it was the simplest things. I found out that they thought that diarrhea was a disease of too much water. So when a child got diarrhea, they would stop giving them water and they would dehydrate. A typical birth was the woman would crouch and drop the child on a filthy stone and cut the cord with a rock and probably wouldn't wash the baby, for God. So we just taught some real fundamentals of public health, and it's made a really remarkable difference. We also have a program where we actually build schools and provide supplies and fund teachers at a variety of schools. And as I said before, the education thing is, this is what goes on in these schools to teach these kids. These kids are learning how to wash their faces and brush their teeth and even pick under their legs to teach me how to clean my fingernails, I think. I think I've got yak turd under them right now. Sorry. this is a kid who hasn't learned how to wash himself, and that's how you see most of the kids there. This is a typical classroom. You'll note the mud walls, the mud floor, a little bit of carpet and a blackboard. We could visit schools like this, and the headmaster will beg us to give them money for a blackboard. This is how much they want to learn, you know, $5 for a blackboard. So, and there's no light because there's no skylights. They're just built out of tin roofs and rocks, and there's no light, so they'll teach a lot of the classes outside. So here's a seeds classroom where we've plastered the walls and put white paint on them and plastered the floor, and we have dedicated teachers and coloured photos, and they teach them all in English, and it's fabulous to visit this school. And if you know, KP actually leads some of his REAI clients on visits to this school, and I've been there, and I get adorned with like hundreds of cutters, which is a traditional way of honouring somebody, and then they do a performance for us when we get there. I'm sure they're still dancing, but if you went over there, and KP would take you to visit this school, it is a wonderful, wonderful experience. We also have boarding schools. One of the issues in this area near the Tibetan border is that they tend to send their, if a family can, they'll send their children down to monastery schools. And they go to monastery schools to get educated, and then they become monks and they stay in Kathmandu. So all the educated people end up down in the big city, and there's no educated people in the villages. So we've built and funded a boarding school now, where there's an encouragement because we provide meals, Tibetan education, and English and Nepali, and encouragement to get the people to stay there, and so that they can make that area of the country prosper more. We also build water delivery systems for villages. It's an unbelievably typical Nepali village. A woman, and the woman does all the work, spends most of her time collecting water. She may have to walk a kilometer or two to fill up her jugs of water, walk back again, irrigate the fields, cook, wash the kids, cook the food, and that's how they spend most of their day. So by a very, very simple system of building holding tanks and running pipes down to the villages, we have running water, better irrigation. And our projects have been incredibly sustainable because we do absolutely nothing from the top down. We don't go anywhere and say, you need this. We think you should do this. Go to Nepal and see where some team from Germany or something has come in and built an irrigation system. And I bet you a year later it's fallen apart because the villagers were not involved from the start. They have to come to us. They have to donate the labor. They have to donate the land. They have to form a committee to maintain and supervise the project that's been initiated at their behest. So it's been extremely, and what's happening now is that the neighboring village sees, well, these people have got these healthy crops, and the kids are clean, and they look healthy, everything looks healthier. seeds, will you build a system for us? And we typically build a system for about a 500 or 700 person village for around $10,000 to $12,000, which is not a lot of money to provide drinking water for a village like that. We've also built several hundred composting houses, outhouses, because subsistence farmers, every little piece of land that they have, they grow the vegetables, you know, so they go to the toilet. They go to the toilet right next to the cabbages, you know. It's not good. So we built these composting outhouses, which have been a great success. We built a few hundred of them, and they're for villagers. They're not for trekkers. We also sponsor a ashram for elderly women. If you have been a woman in domestic service to a family in Nepal, when you get old and have to retire, you have no family of your own and no support. And we found out about this woman who has built an ashram to support these women. And so we've built a meditation center, a clinic, a kitchen, and some rooms so that they can expand their services to these wonderful elderly people in a home outside of Kathmandu. We also provide some funding to a school for deaf people. And we provide some scholarships to kids who were born in this sort of situation and now go to a very nice private school in Kathmandu. Our agreement with them is that they have to agree to go back to their villages up on the Tibet border and work as teachers in their villages, and we'll pay for their education. And Dharma Norbu, who's this wonderful, wonderful kid, is our oldest student, and he's going to college now, and he's completely dedicated to going back and teaching his people. That's all he wants to do. And I don't know if it makes him a better person, but he's a vegetarian as well. So that's been a good, successful program for us. And here's the kids waving and thanking everybody for their support. And I just, because I think I tend to wear on people after a while, I'd like to just now show you a presentation of some slides, some images of Nepal with some music, and so you might just want to kick back a little bit, and F1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and enjoy this.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. You're listening to The Majesty of the Himalayas with Keith Goldstein. Thank you. Well, I know we've run out a little bit over, but I want to take a few questions, if there are any questions.
Test.
Curious, is there much interaction between Tibet and Nepal, and are the ethnic cultural peoples a mixture, or are they pretty separate?
Well,
historically,
there's a lot of trade between the two. Just people who live on the borders have traditionally always done a lot of trade between the two countries, which was somewhat disrupted after 1959, after the Dalai Lama fled, and there was some the borders, the Chinese crossed the border, locked the borders, and in fact the Chinese for a while there persuaded the Nepali government to shoot to kill any refugees they saw crossing. That's another issue, and in fact it was our own Senator Feinstein who threatened to withhold most favored some trading agreement with Nepal unless they rescinded that, which they did wisely. So we should be very grateful to Senator Feinstein for that. There's still trade. The people, it's interesting that the people in these Tibetan communities in Nepal consider themselves Nepali citizens, have the rights of Nepali citizens, and unlike Tibetans within China, have freedom of religion. And so if you want to see a very pure, unadulterated Tibetan religion that's not hampered by Chinese cadres overlooking it, that area of Nepal is a very good place to see it. There is more trade there now, but it's just agrarian trade, you know, sacks of salt for sacks of sugar and things like that.
Hi, can you tell us a little bit about, or what you know about, larger efforts to bring drinking water to villages?
No, I don't know much about that, I'm afraid. There's somebody here, I'm sure, does. Do you know something about that?
No, but you probably have the answer to this question. You mentioned that the biofuel systems that you were putting in villages are quite expensive. I'm just curious, how much is it per unit?
Well, for us, we consider it a lot of money because it's about $300, $350. You know, the village, the household has to do the labor, but what costs them, we like to spend that money to benefit more than one family. And most of the money, by the way, is in the purchase of materials, because I think a bag of concrete in Nepal costs almost as much as it does down at Boronio, you know, in San Francisco. Transporting the materials is what costs the money. You have to pay the porters to get it up there. Yes, Bruce. Well, we have a fantastic... look, let me tell you that if the villagers do it with oversight from Nepali nationals, so we have a staff in Kathmandu that oversees the projects, and when we build a water delivery system, they donate the land, we buy the materials, and we send an engineer up there and one of our staff people up there to show them the villagers how to build it. And we don't really get involved. You know what? We just fund it. You know, and we oversee it. We provide oversight, and we just started off. You know, KP said, "Well, you should form a charity." And you know what? I came back here, and myself and a woman in Oregon just got our 501c3, and we just started writing some letters to people that we sent, that we knew, and we started getting donations. And you know, we're still this year. Our budget will be about $130,000 to $140,000. Which, by the way, it goes, you know, that's like $1.5 million in Nepal in terms of the value that we get from it. And I'm sure that nobody else can build a water delivery system for a few hundred villages for $10,000 like we're able to do. We're amazingly efficient. And so we just people hear about it, then they donate. They go trekking, they hear about seeds. If they go with REI and see those girls dancing, we've got them right away, no doubt about it. I'll be very sad when they grow up, those little girls. Yes. There is a multitude of NGOs working in Nepal. They're from so many different countries, and there's so many different NGOs working there, and there's a tremendous number of people doing a tremendous amount of good work. As I mentioned before, the AHF and here in San Francisco really does a lot of really fantastic work and probably does more than anybody else there. They get a lot of government money from governmental organizations as well, and they partner together. Seeds and the AHF have very good relationships, and one day we will actually work together on a project. We're actually working. We've been doing, what I didn't show you were some of our environmental restoration projects because we ran out a bit of time, but we've been doing some fantastic stuff with Bird Conservation of Nepal to help in environmental efforts, which we kind of tie in with health clinics. We send a doctor, a team of medical people to a place and set up a health clinic, so the villagers all come and stand in line, and whilst they're there, make them sit through sessions on how to think about environmental protection, and that's been a good program for us as well.
I'm familiar with what you're talking about with the use of wood and trees for burning and creating heat. I was there in 1994, and there was scarcely a tree around Namche Bazaar and other places. Is there anything going on with reforestation at this point? We've got some amazing programs here in the U.S., especially under Obama now. They're putting, you know, tens of millions into this as one of the green initiatives, and I wonder what's happening there.
Well, I think that there definitely is reforestation programs going on there, and I don't think that they're on that sort of scale by any means. And Norbu, do you happen to know who's doing reforestation programs in Nepal?
There's quite a bit of reforestation going on there, not as much as Bhutan, but in Nepal, up in the Everest area, because of education over the past decade, the forests have really grown. They've been, millions of trees that have been planted, and so up there it's been a big success. Other parts of Nepal they're trying, but wood is still used as fuel. So,
yeah, did you hear that? It's been a big success in the Khumbu, millions of trees, but elsewhere they're still using wood for fuel. They don't get it yet. It's too easy. So if you go there trekking, don't you dare let your trekking agency use wood for fuel so that you can take a hot shower because you're used to having one three times a day.
Well, I'd like to thank Keith Goldstein, co-founder of Nepal Seeds, for his comments and wonderful insights and slide presentation here today. We also want to thank our audience here as well as our radio audience. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 103rd year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.